Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host and firm believer in art as medicine, Mikala Ann. This week, we welcome artist, astrologer, gold and silversmith, and talisman maker extraordinaire, Jeannie Desert, onto the podcast to chat about the intersection between art and academia. Jeannie has been making incredibly breathtaking talismans for the fixed stars and planets, and when I received my own for Alcyone, I was struck by the incredible research and source materials Jeannie drew from to produce this potent piece of magic and art. This begins a discussion on the rejection of binaries, the horrors of enlightenment, the necessity of art as medicine, and the exaltation of dance among metaphors for weaving in and out of the tension of things. We chat identity, academia, a little bit of philosophy, all with a focus on art and imagination as a practice in both the craft of life and the crooked path. I thoroughly enjoyed and was inspired by Jeannie's compassion of the heart and expansion of the mind, as well as her attention to utilizing language metaphors that give space and healing for the self's relationship with the body. I do not doubt that you will find it inspiring too. This podcast is brought in part by listeners like you. If you want to support the show and its humble host, hop on over to the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox, where you can listen to the extended episode content that is available there, as well as join in on our community Discord server.
Mikala, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. It's really exciting. I'm Jeannie, and I'm an artist, golden silversmith, talisman maker, astrologer, and witch.
Amazing! That's quite the repertoire. So I know, like, through the way that we connected was through your astrological talisman jewelry that you make. And so what I find so interesting about it is not only did I receive this like amazing work of art, but I also received this really well-informed like packet that explained your research, you know, the books that you use to get what material, why you chose certain things, all of this. So there seems to be a combination of both a scholar and an artist in the way that you approach making your talismans. So would you say that that's correct?
Yeah, definitely. I come from an academic arts background, so I have both an undergrad and a master's in fine art. So that really came very naturally to me. I guess for many, many years, I've been really focused on the materiality of jewelry making. And then years ago when I really moved into, it developed over time, everything sort of expanded, moving into my astrological talisman making. With each talisman, it's become more and more, the research has become more and more in-depth, to the point where I make little booklets to accompany the talismans. Yeah.
So it was kind of like a little academic article about the piece of art.
Yeah. And actually, I feel like it started off more academic. I'm trying to kind of bring it back a little bit to be more experiential. I'm comfortable in that academic field of writing, and because it's what I know, it's what I learned. And I think I'm trying to unlearn that in a way and trying to get into the, sort of unpacking the embodied experience as well in a way that's less academic. Yeah.
So when you say the embodied experience, are you implying that like you want to use more embodied language to talk about these things?
And just, I think writing more creatively is a way to get there, because I'm becoming very aware of trying not to dissect the mystery.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something that's been kind of being shown to me recently. It's like, be careful.
Oh, I love that you said that. Yeah, I've been thinking about that lately, actually, because, you know, I'm one of those people that's always kind of been infatuated with the mystery. And like, you know, like, on the High Priestess card, how she's like covered by that veil. And there's, you know, something that Crowley says in Book of Thoth about like, if you try to see beyond the veil, like she'll take her sword and come at you. And that's why she has the sword in her lap. But I've always kind of been like, I bet there's a way I can politely ask for the veil to be penetrated and she will let me peek beyond her skirt or something. But then I started thinking about that metaphor, penetrate beyond the veil or penetrate the mystery. And I was like, why is this so violent? Like this, there is a violence even to the language I'm using, wherein I am literally trying to force this, the female embodiment of the mystery to unclothe herself for me. Like and that made me kind of take a step back and say, like, what do I actually want? Like, why do I actually even want that? You know?
Well, Michaela, that's really astute. I'm like, yeah, amazing. I'm right there with you. It's like, well, it's just this, like, I want to know, but there, I think there is a soft and gentle, I think maybe it's about entering into the dance and.
Ooh, I love that.
Rather than a fight, it's a dance perhaps.
Please tell me you have read Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff.
No, I haven't, but I'll add that to the list.
So this is a book on cognitive linguistics, and it's basically talking about the way that language use is actually shaped around metaphor. And the very first example he gives in the book is the metaphor argument equals war. I won that argument. I had to defend myself against him. You know, I've thrown down his rebuttal, you know, whatever. These are all very violent metaphors that we use. And he said in the book, he said, how would we argue with people if the metaphor we used for argument was dance?
Yeah, amazing.
So it can't, you said that. That's amazing.
Yeah, I love that. Because I'm trying to bring all of that into my writing as well. Like, how do we not tell people what to do? How do we, you know, like, how do we sort of, like, as soon as I feel like within the arts practice is very beautiful in the sense that I feel like it's a true communion. And then when we get to the writing, like, how do we sort of honor that sort of communion we're having within the arts practice? Mm-hmm. And so be careful about always having to be right, or, and maybe, you know, it's not really about that, like, about.
Well, is there even such a thing as being right? I think is.
Well, that's a thing. And I feel like that can happen with writing, especially with like academic writing, because like in the sort of academic sphere, it's kind of like you've got a point and you're, you know.
And you have to prove it. That's why
you have to prove it. Yes.
Oh, wait, they even call it when you give your thesis, it's a defense. You're going into war.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that is a lot of what I have been reading lately, and I'm very blessed at Rice, I will have to say, like, I'm blessed that my teachers and like all my professors are pretty more in the like post-structuralism camp.
Yeah.
But the main thing that they have been teaching me in school is like you have to unlearn all of that stuff that you learned as an analytic philosopher in your bachelor's program because it is making you sick. Like it's actually they've not phrased it that way, but like that is my too long didn't read of like what I'm learning in pretty much all my classes is story and fiction become reality when we choose to believe it. And so history is nothing but a story. And we can't ever really say that this happened exactly the way we think it did. But as it becomes fact, quote unquote fact, people begin to tell themselves that that story was true. And then, so then it's this weird paradox where it only becomes true in retrospect because everybody believes it, not because it was ever actually true.
Yeah. 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 The stories we tell ourselves, the stories we tell each other.
With that in mind, also what I really loved about the pamphlet that I received, and just so that everybody is aware, you've made multiple of them, but I have the Alcyone one. So in the pamphlet, there were multiple different mythologies and stories. And one of the things that I found so interesting about the Alcyone talisman, which I can't speak on any of the other ones you've made, but like my relationship with that star prior was bird related. And then you brought a snake. So this talisman is a snake spirit, not necessarily a bird. And there were stories that you shared in the pamphlet that were snake related and Pleiades related, just like Alcyone is related to the Pleiades. So I'm wondering, it's like hard for me. My question is kind of this like weird ambiguity of like snake, bird, and they show up in multiple different mythologies as being the like as above, so below, the birds are always more theurgic and the snakes are always more chthonic. And so what is the story there? Like, what can you share with us about this weaving of the bird and the snake?
So specifically with the Alcyone, like stories, the bird and the snake, or?
So what I'm really trying to get at is stories can tell the same thing through different symbols. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be some sort of similarity there between a snake and a bird. And maybe this happened in your Saracene talisman, and maybe there are multiple different, so other people came to you and said, well, normally I work with it with this kind of symbol, but you brought in this one. And so it's not necessarily a question about the commonality between birds and snakes so much as the stories we tell and like why this matters and why there can be multiplicity. And like, does that make sense?
Yes, totally. I think the, like with the Alcyone talismans, like the serpents, I experience as flying. So, and then I can find the connection through the flying serpents and the birds, because then that sort of, you know, rather than the chthonic snakes that exist purely in the underworld, we have the flying serpents that are of the heavens. And, you know, but they're of the same, also of the same nature in a way as the serpents of the underworld. So it's kind of bringing in this connection between the above and the below. And this, what I was really kind of alluding to in that pamphlet is that we have to go through the underworld to get to the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was in the Veritas Genie, the newest book. Do you know that conference?
Yes, the one that happens in Olympia, actually.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. So the most recent little book they published, Jesse Hathaway actually has an amazing essay in that book. Okay, so where is it? So, like, so the popular phrase, as above, so below. The oldest extant versions are 8th century Arabic. And the earliest translation into Latin is the 12th century, which reads, the above is from the below. The below is from the above.
Ooh, oh, that sent chills down my spine.
Right. So that's exactly what it is. Like, that's the exact translation. And then it got changed at some point to being as above, so below. But the above is from the below is basically saying that, you know, we go through the underworld to get to the heavens. And so it kind of, it's there we find this sort of merging of the thonic deities or spirits with the celestial ones.
So would you say that each star has a kind of frame for the mythology, and then the stories may differ but fit that frame?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, because I just don't think we know all the, we don't have all the mythologies either. Like, I feel like it's, you know, we're piecing together fragments of our past and our stories, and, you know, we're hoping to be spirit-led along the way into sort of new understandings or how we can frame it within our lives now. And I don't know, like, it's a big question mark. It's a big mystery, I think.
I think it's better to say I don't know than to try to give a metaphysical answer. I respect that a lot. Before we pressed record, you were saying something about the spirits communicating to us through mythology and, like, through story. And do you think you could, like, explain a bit more what you meant by that?
Well, I guess the stories, the mythologies are, they're sort of this, it's this liminal space, right? I see mythology as sort of this, we enter into a liminal space where we enter into the mythologies, and that's the space that I think we need to be in for the spirits to be able to hear the spirits. So we can enter into these stories, and that's where we can, like, have that communion. And that takes me back to, like, sort of the idea of writing creatively. It's, again, getting into those, perhaps getting into those liminal spaces again.
I know it, like, sounds a bit paradoxical, but it does sound like the implication is the imaginal space is just as real as the material space. And
perhaps more so.
I would agree with that, but yeah. I can't prove it. Yeah.
No. But, you know, our dreams, like, we spend half of our life, well, maybe not everyone, depends how much you sleep at night, but a lot of us spend just as much time, you know, in the imaginal, in our dreams, as we do in this sort of waking reality, mm-hmm. but not much thought is given to that.
I feel like it's interesting. We're like, what we're talking about is this tension between the creative life of the artist and the intellectual pursuit of the academic. And I think because of the way that Western society has grown, just the conditions surrounding it have resulted in our society kind of viewing those two things on a binary. Like, you are either an artist or you are an academic. And there, or even if you're trying to do both, you're given metaphors like you're wearing two different hats, or you got to change hats or code switch to talk with one group of people to another group of people, as if these are two completely different spaces. And mm-hmm. What I am loving from you with your academic background and what I'm struggling with in my academic life right now, and both of us identifying also as artists, is like being a halfie, but like also having to admit that that nature of being a halfie doesn't actually exist. Like, the falsity is the binary that I either participate in art or I participate in academia. Those two desires are not actually separate, and it's actually potentially healing, I think, for both of them to kind of merge them back into one, because when you bring that imaginal and that creativity into the academic, it's releasing that need to prove I've penetrated the mystery.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you refuse you know, if you refuse the art and you're doing just the academic, you're not thinking creatively enough to come up with anything that might actually be a new profound or...
Yeah, there's the innovation comes through creativity. Yeah. Yeah. All innovation comes through creativity. And it's interesting. So like we can think about, oh, when did science become divorced from magic? Like, and we do have a particular time. And then my other question is, like, did that happen around the same time as the invention of lights? Because I have a, yeah. Because it's interesting, like, when we invented lights, we lost transitional space, because before lights, we'd exist in a time when there was day, and then there was a long period of transition from day to night, and then again from night to morning, to full day. And like those transitional spaces, like, are they liminal spaces where we kind of slowly sort of switch, well, like move through one period to another, like day and night is the duality, and then we have those in-between spaces that we move through. But now we just have lights, so we go from, like, we go from day, we switch the lights on, and then it's time for bed, we close the lights. And so we're not spending any time in a transitional space. And so maybe it's a loss of that transitional space, a loss of the liminality that makes us create such intensive binaries. Because we're literally went from being these humans that spent, like, had all these different phases to their life. Like, is that making sense to you? Day and
yes.
Then the...
Yeah, sort of. My whole thing is... So I am going to say, based off of what, and I am still...
So Enlightenment's earlier than that, right? It's like 1600s or something.
So yes. So the way that we, because this is actually the kind of stuff that's going to be coming on my final exams in a month and a half. Like in my methods class, we're like learning the tension between Enlightenment and basically the historiosity, reason versus the material, the ideal versus the material. And this conflict that was happening in philosophy, in German idealism, which is before Edison.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, is the Enlightenment around the 1600s?
So this says Kant was 1724 was his birth.
Okay, yeah.
So... he basically was, you know, we gain freedom through critical thinking.
He's a progenitor of the Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. He's kind of the first guy that really raised that flag. And so that was like, reason is king. Like, he even wrote a whole book on reason being what we should worship religiously. And... then, of course, you know, you end up with Marx, who are kind of bringing in the historiosity and saying, like, look, if we use a historical methodology and break this stuff down, you can see that, like, what I said to you earlier, like, history is not a progress. It's not like Hegel has this idea of, like, the acorn becoming the oak tree, as if Enlightenment is this, like, forever linear progress forward.
And so Marx was like, no, it's circular, it's cyclical, is it? Or is that what his idea was, or no?
He was more like saying that if you view it, if you like look at things from a historical perspective, you can see that it's actually conditional based off of what's going on in people's lives. But he still had a very, like, there is a true yeah. way we can go about, like, it's yeah. kind of funny because
yes.
you can
yes.
look.
It's that thing again. It's like, this is the way. This is the right way.
They're so close, but then yeah. they don't take what they're saying far enough. And then the philosopher that comes after them is basically always just going, yes, but you didn't take it far enough. Because, like, Nietzsche does the same thing in the genealogy of morals, where he's trying to do this from a historiosity way. But, of course, his science is all fucked up. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Most of the genealogy in that book is not accurate. And then, you know, you end up with Foucault, who is kind of like, yeah, we can use history to dissect everything down and understand the mechanisms of why things are. but history dissection is never going to answer metaphysical questions. And therefore, post-structuralism happens where people just kind of go, things can be either true or not true, depending on the way you're looking at it. And so there's now a progression in academia within the humanities, not within STEM, but within the humanities to kind of separate from this binary. I don't know, like, this is why I would like to talk to my Western esotericism teacher and ask what you were saying about lights. But I almost am like, I want to say that the lights, like, my hypothesis would be that was magical to people.
It was. Oh, it was very magical to people.
Was that not happening around the same time as the Spiritist movement?
Oh, that sounds right.
Yes, yeah. Because that was the period of time when people started to miss God. That was when they started to be like, actually, reason is hurting me and I want there to be wonder in the world.
Totally, totally. Yeah, there's sort of a renaissance.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right there. Yeah, you're right. But I guess it's sort of more like a, like, oh, what is the sort of the wider sort of, like, I guess the implications of,
I think
of
you're right.
Lights, just switching us between two binaries, like two extremes. And so what does that do to the brain, and what does it mean to lose the liminal spaces between day and night? It's good to think about. Like, it's like, oh, so what are we doing to ourselves through, like, how are we, like, separating ourselves from the imaginal just through the materiality of our everyday lives?
Well, here's an interesting question. When you think about it, it was magical to people at first when light bulbs happened, and then it became mundane.
Well, it is mundane, but it's still magic, like, really, like.
And I agree with that, like, all, yeah, science is magic and all magic, yes, is science. But I think if, yes, you, like, went up to your average person and you said, do you experience wonder when you turn on a light bulb? They're not going to say yes.
But it doesn't mean that the magic we're doing doesn't also disconnect us from these, you know, disconnect us from the imaginal. Like, we can have magic that also disconnects us. It doesn't necessarily sort of re-enchant our, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think of all.
Only insofar as if I'm stepping away from a binary, I can say that there are times in which magic has sobered me as a way to allow me to re-enchant my life in a more healthy way,
yeah,
or in a more grounded way.
Yeah.
So that way, the unenchantment becomes an anchor to help me create better wonder.
I like that. I like thinking of it like that. So it's almost like, oh, becoming aware of the binary created by the simple light bulb kind of can bring us back into a space of sort of enchanting out. And that's the beauty of candles. Like, we can, you know, we can literally, like, step back into, like, create spaces for ourselves of liminality.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to turn on the lights all the time. We do still have candles. Like, we could, switching from day to night, just leave the lights off. You know,
it's a, yeah, great ambiance when you do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it is creating those environments for ourselves where we can enter into, you know, different spaces.
And there's something liminal about night already, and, like,
yeah,
by creating a sensation in which you never have to face that might also in a way be creating, like, discomfort in the human psyche.
Oh, I 100% think that's actually what's happening.
Why do I feel so much need to control the mystery?
Yeah.
Is it because I have never had to sit in the uncomfortability of darkness?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe I could cure, yeah, my control issues if I stop turning the lights on when the sun goes down.
Yeah. Like, I feel like so many people think that, and this is, like, again, like we were talking earlier before we started recording about, you know, the psychologizing of everything. It's like it's like we've come to the place where everything, you know, we're moving into Pluto in Aquarius. And I think it's really important for us to start thinking about how we make everything mental, and actually there are things that are happening to us due to the our physical environments.
Yeah.
And we're kind of, again, that's a binary, we're divorcing the physical from the mental, and they are connected. There is no binary between them. So we can create mental states by changing our physical environment.
It's also interesting. We're talking a lot about language, like language creates the way in which I even can engage in the imaginal. So if I am utilizing words that exist within a harsh binary, I am already restricting my imaginative ability to create. It's interesting what you said about discourse and the pathologizing. That was really my takeaway from reading Foucault's History of Sexuality.
Okay, I haven't read it.
The main thing is basically what you said. It's basically it's basically saying why that when we started talking about sex and trying to like pin it down into discourse and turn it into identity structures, like that was actually us pathologizing something. He said, sex is a verb. It's an action. It's not a thing you are. There's no identity attached to it. But when you create identity attached to it and you say, well, now I'm gay or I'm queer or I'm poly or I'm, you know, mono or whatever. I forgot the word. I literally forgot the word for monogamy. Wow. Okay. Anyways, like when we tell ourselves that's what we are, it actually distances us from the totality of that experience and forces us to pathologize it.
So interesting. I was just thinking about that earlier in my write. I was writing about Alphard earlier, and I was writing about this. As soon as we start, like we exist as a multiplicity. I think like each of us are, like we're very multiplicitous. We are in flux. Like we don't really, I don't think we have fixed identities. Like
yeah,
I really
me too.
Don't think that. And so as soon as we start putting fixed identities on ourselves, we're just creating all these boxes for ourselves. And
that's where the suffering comes.
That's where the suffering comes. Yeah. Like I think over my life, and I feel like I've, like it's almost like I've been so many different people. Like I've had so many different experiences, and it's, and I just want to let that be. Like I don't need to define all of that as this was when I was doing what this was, you know. It's like, oh, I am. Yes, it is pathological to do that. Yeah. Yeah. And it is also that there's the mystery there, and it's like the dissection of the mystery again. Like we're killing it.
Oh,
we're dissecting it.
That made a light bulb go off in my head because it's like the mystery isn't just the universe. The mystery is also me.
Yeah. 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 And then that re-enchants you. Don't like that sort of re-enchantment of the self. It's like, oh, I just like became... Yeah.
I think, you know, we're constantly in a state of becoming, and that's why I really love George Bataille's essay on the solar anus. It's basically...
It sounds interesting.
It's super fun. It's very short. I will link it in the episode description. It, like, wouldn't take anybody more than 15 minutes to read, but it's basically just talking about how the sun rises and falls every day. And so the sun actually is born and dies every day.
Yeah.
And if like the self is the sun, and so you actually are constantly living and dying within each second. And the reason why he says solar anus is because he's talking about how we have to shit out the excess. If you try to hold on to the excess, it makes you sick. If you keep trying to identify with something that you were yesterday, even though you've received new data and you've gotten a brand new sleep and you're a completely new person, but you're still trying to identify with who you were yesterday, you're going to be hurt. You're going to hurt yourself, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds, that I'd love to read that. That's
I'll
great.
Send it
and
to
that
you.
Really, that's really interesting because it's like goes into our astrology. Like
exactly.
I've been thinking about, because I have some solar talismans coming out next month, and I've been thinking a lot about that, about how the sun has the, you know, is the most like regenerative, you know, star within our little system here.
I love how complex the sun is.
Yeah, like, it, you know, I think a lot about the cycles because I work a lot with cycle risings. And, you know, a lot of the, like all of our fixed stars, they're usually going through a year-long cycle of death and rebirth and then being in the sky. But the sun is literally every single day.
Yeah.
So this is why recently I said the sun is punk as fuck. Like, how much more punk is that? Like, dying daily, like just shedding skin, battling the dragon. Very cool. I don't think enough is given. I don't know. I feel like within astrology, it's like you start with your sun sign and then we move away from the sun and we're like, oh, the astrology is so large. But then we kind of, maybe we forget a little bit about our sun. And
I think so too. I've been thinking about that a lot, even like, because I do a lot of solar magic. Like, I have a very close relationship with the sun. Mm-hmm. And, like, things that the sun can do that people forget. Invisibility. Mm-hmm. Like, that's yes. a thing people tend to go to the moon for. But guess what? Yeah. You shine bright enough, nobody can look at you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's...
Oh. Yeah, bravo.
And
like
the chthonic sun... I mean, there are so many wonderful mysteries about the chthonic sun in Egyptian mythology. Mm-hmm. And this was actually my, like, hypothesis on what I think the headless rite is all about.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because it is very reminiscent of the sixth hour of the Amduat. So the Amduat is like the hours of the sun, the chthonic hours of the sun. So the night hours. And in this journey, when Ra goes into the underworld, in the sixth hour, he joins with Osiris. And mm-hmm. Osiris is actually headless. And then the sun replaces the head. And it, in that sixth hour, it becomes the union of as below mm-hmm. is above, right? Yeah. And so, and for me, like, the headless rite is kind of a call to that ritual in mm-hmm. that you're kind of doing this same thing where you're slicing off your head and asking the solar, I'm going to use a Kabbalistic word, but like that Tifereth energy, mm-hmm. if you're a Gnostic, that Christ consciousness,
yep.
and you're asking it to kind of fill you so that, because every day you have to be headless. Every day you have to chop yeah. off that head and you yeah. need to ask the divinity to show you, not even to show you anything, to fill you with the power and the courage to continue with a new day, mm-hmm. honestly. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because we could kind of relate that to like our, we go to sleep every night and we kind of are chopping off our own head. We're going to sleep and we're, I wouldn't say leaving our body, but kind of are. Like we are, yeah. And so there is a real aspect. Yeah, I love connecting the sun to the headless rite. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic. You should write about that.
Well, I taught on it.
You taught on it.
I did this at Salem Symposium, and then I've had the feedback.
When was that?
2 years ago.
Yeah, okay.
But I have had the feedback to turn it into a Haydon pamphlet, but I'm not going to do that until I graduate.
Oh,
that'll
yeah.
happen once I graduate.
Yeah. What are you studying right now? Like, you're doing philosophy, right?
Actually, my degree is going to be religious studies.
Oh, that, I read that. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Brilliant. So your undergrad was philosophy, and now you're doing your master's, PhD.
I'm doing a master's right now. Master's, yeah. So I'm doing a master's mm-hmm. in religious studies. And it just so happens that at Rice, their methods class is just a philosophy of religion. It's literally
cool.
just philosophy of religion. So
that's cool.
But I'm lucky because the program that I'm in, it's called GEM. So it's Gnosticism, Esotericism, and Mysticism. So I'm actually...
Amazing. What?
Yeah, it's super fun.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why when you were like, do you think people got disenchanted? And I was like, we literally just had a class on science and magic, and I think my
wow.
teacher will be upset if I don't have an answer to this.
Yeah.
Not that she's listening. I hope not.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool.
It's fun. Yeah. I'm happy. But it's an interesting thing because I'm in this weird place where I had spent the past 6 years unlearning a lot of my academic writing style, mm-hmm. or even just like the way that I was doing research, because I was getting a lot of feedback in the occult, like in a culture where people were like, this is too academic and you need to make it more accessible for people. So I unlearned the academia, and now mm-hmm. I'm like back to having to relearn it's a whole yeah. thing, but I kind of enjoy, I enjoy weaving in and out of these spaces. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and my identity is different each and every day. Each and every second. I get to be mm-hmm. an artist. I get to be an academic. I get to be whatever I want to be.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, I guess I think of it like that as well. Like it's sort of, you know, it's really lovely to have the space to do that as well, isn't it? It's like,
it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what I think is so beautiful about the community that's blossoming within a culture right now, because, mm-hmm. and this is like a huge critique in my Western esotericism class, is like people get so frustrated that we have to like use Arthur Waite as a primary source because like he did not do good academic research. Mm-hmm. But where we are in a culture right now is like we have all these incredible researchers mm-hmm. coming in to say, I can fulfill both. I can do yeah. the art, and I can do the research, and I can explain yeah. to you why the art matters. Yeah. And if yeah. I'm doing a performative dance, I have a whole list of correspondences of why I chose to use yeah. this herb, and this song yeah. was in C sharp, which is related to this sphere, and people are, it's so inspiring. A culture right now is so inspiring. Mm-hmm. We are mm-hmm. in an amazing time in magic.
Yeah. Yeah, it is true. We really are. Yeah. And it's sort of bringing the, it's really, I feel really deeply about bringing the arts, like people, for people to understand that art is magic. I think that's a really, that's something that's, yeah, really important to me. And it's, I'm really trying to unpack that in a way that I can explain it to people. And I intend to for my Astromagia presentation, but it's something that I'm, you know, it's something that is just really inherent to me, inherent to my practice. It's been there the whole time. And it's sort of like I understand it on a nonverbal level uh-huh. Because it doesn't really, it's one of those things that exists on a nonverbal level. Like I think, well, art existed, I think, before, like, you know, there is the idea that art existed before we had words.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. So there is a sense of art having this pre-verbal experience to it that sometimes can be very hard to explain it in words.
I definitely agree with you, but I will say that I think this whole thing that we've been talking about with the imaginal and like the imaginal being potentially, insofar as you and I are hypothesizing, the state that precedes the kingdom, like the dream and the imaginal happens first. And in that way, because of that, because of the enlightenment, because of people like poor misguided Kant, the academic is castrated from that. Because of the, yes. the Protestant Reformation, because they wanted to interpret the Bible literally and say, you crazy Catholics and your metaphors, right?
Yeah.
And this yeah. was a war against the imagination as much as it was against Catholic ideology.
Oh, 100%. The Enlightenment was a war against the imaginal. Like, yes, I'm right there with you. How long is it going to take us to unravel all of that? I wonder, you know, it's like how deeply fucked are we because of the Enlightenment? I guess, I have to keep reminding myself that, you know, there is a lot of things that have come. I'd much rather dance with a Catholic than a Protestant or an atheist, you know, because it is, I think atheism is the actually end result of enlightenment, really.
I think most people who claim to be atheist are not actually atheists.
Well, no, they're science.
Yeah, they're scientists, and they're just like their god is nihilism. Like their god is death. Like, sorry, you are worshiping nothingness. Like you're still participating in some form of religious belief.
Yeah, you just don't really. You're not aware of it, which is even more dangerous.
Exactly. Exactly.
Lack of forethought.
I think like this has been for me. Like when I started the podcast, I did not know that it was going to become about how all magic is art and all artists are already doing magic, even if they aren't aware of that. Mm-hmm. And being aware of it will elevate you as both an artist and a magician. That was kind of something that the podcast became about over time. Mm-hmm. But it makes sense because it's like, well, magic is an art. It is a dance. You are creating. You are moving energy. And you can think about it all day. You can think about it till the cows come home. But then you end up falling in weird pit.
Yeah, I think where art comes in and where art can really be a landline is that art takes you out of your head. And I feel like it's really important within these practices to get out of your head. Mm-hmm. Like, and getting out of your head is where the spirits are. You know, this is where we enter into the liminal spaces, where we start to over intellectualize things, is where we lose access to the path. And also where we start wandering these like really defined paths. Like that, you know, these are brightly lit areas, you know, like we need to sort of step off. And how do we step off? But engaging in, I think, material practices within like, and all sorts of art, you know, it doesn't need to be like just one type of, you know, for me, it's my hands. So it's like engaging in material practices with my hands. And that's a way I move out of my headspace and into, you know, an imaginal space where I can be, I enter into the dance, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Enter into the dance. This reminded me of what you were saying earlier about embodied language. And I asked what you meant by that. And now I'm thinking, embodied language is when you move your hands. Embodied language is the facial features you make when you aren't paying attention to your own thoughts. I don't know.
I feel like embodied language can be like when you start writing and you let yourself go and then you let the words come out. And that sort of, in that sort of more, I guess, what is it called? It's like stream of consciousness writing, and just different kind of writing practices that sort of take you away from, that can kind of move you out of, again, over-intellectualizing.
Yeah. No, I love that.
I think, like, you know, we can find a lot in folk practices and in ancient practices, you know, we can kind of, what were our ancestors doing? They were dancing around fires. They were, you know, making art in sand. They were making pottery. They were, you know, making figurines to the gods. They were, you know, all these practices. And it's like now it's so focused on, like, you know, I feel like there's this big focus on doing these sort of step-by-step sort of procedures, but it's like, where is the art? Where is the art of our ancestors? And
as soon as you put us in a binary where you're either successful or not, then you've created a place where artists now feel pressure or anxiety, and you actually lose a bunch of people who probably would have made outstanding art. But they feel undeserving or unqualified or whatever.
Yes, and that's the problem with the academic world. You know, I went through the academic system. Doesn't mean I loved it. I went through it because I thought I had to. And I think, like, it's maybe a little bit more difficult within the art sort of sphere. And it could be the academic system that you're in, and it could be the time period that you're doing it, you know. But for me, it was kind of, I felt a major push to really make my work academic and fit within sort of certain parameters. And I think it was actually beneficial to me in the end because it made me really understand what I want my practice to be. Mm-hmm. It was through that sort of this sort of adversity of the system.
That kind of middle way in all things. I'm definitely not anti-academia, even if I am anti the system and the structure of academia.
Mm. Yes, I agree. I love academia for what? Like, oh gosh, I don't think I would have really been able to do what I do now if it wasn't for academia. But also there was a big struggle through it to sort of push back against the system of control that academia can also put on you. And I also think that has to do with the time and place that you're within that sort of system. They're all different to each other's.
What was that like as an artist?
Yeah, that was very difficult. I guess like each time, like I happened in my undergrad and it happened again in my master's, but I kept, you know, I kept going back for more. But each time it resulted in me changing my primary medium that I work in.
What do you mean primary medium?
Like, I guess when I did my master's, I was really focused in painting and I came out of it and I became a gold and silversmith. So, yeah, it catalyst for change.
Well, I think that sounds like a good transition.
Oh, fantastic for me. It actually, I feel like I found, I think of them, I guess, as in a way some kind of language. It feels like I found a language that suits my hands.
Oh, I love that. That's so beautiful.
Yeah. Like, I love painting, but this gold and silversmithing really is something that feels so natural to me. Yeah, but I'm working in printmaking again. So, and that was actually, I did my undergrad in printmaking. So, yeah, I move through different mediums. It's always in flux.
Yeah. Well, academia did what it was supposed to do. You learned new skills that you wouldn't have otherwise been introduced to. I mean, it's the same thing for me. It's like I had all these questions about religion and about the history of thought and ideas, and I was only getting so far on my own independent research.
Yeah.
Putting myself in a classroom environment, it's like, do I think I want to teach at the academic level? Absolutely not. Like, once I get degree, even if I do choose to go back and get a PhD, I'm not going to be in academia. I just want those skills and that knowledge, and then I'm going to take it and do whatever I want. Well,
yeah, maybe.
That, I mean, when it comes to my PhD, do I want a PhD? I don't know. But I'm already in the MA, so I might as well finish that. I mean, I'm already here.
Yeah. Oh, no, I actually think that academia for art is the struggle. I think I guess, and that's why I say where it's programs, because they don't actually, there was no teaching of skill. Like, it's not teaching. No. So it's not, I guess in my undergrad a little bit, but in my master's it was all academic. Like, it's just all about thinking about your art in an academic. Yeah. Yeah, there's no actual.
But why would you even destroy the imaginal by putting so much emphasis? Like, at the very least, meet each other in the middle. That doesn't make much sense to me.
No. I guess that's just where the programs have gotten to, you know, in the part of the world where I was.
You did this in Australia.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, you know, it has a very contemporary conceptual framework to the programs.
Sure.
So, and that's what I mean by there's something problematic about academic art, because of the push towards the purely conceptual, and that's just the period of, you know, the the period that we're, I guess, in Australia, within the, like, what is important in art at the moment in Australia, and it is conceptual art. So sure. That's the push within the academic programs.
I mean, I don't feel this way about all art, but when it comes to magic, this is my personal preference. Please do not come for me, podcast world. I am allowed to have my own subjective opinion, but I do not like it when people just like do performance art willy-nilly and call it magic, call it a ritual. Even if I am like, you're definitely channeling energy, you're definitely doing something. But that to me is actually dangerous. And it actually scares me when I see people be that flippant about the combination of art and magic, because it is so much more powerful when you're combining them. And if you don't have the intention and you don't have the knowledge, and that's where I'm kind of like, I actually don't think that somebody who purely did art and did not do any of the research is going to excel as a witch or a magician, nor do I think somebody who focuses purely on the academic is going to excel. You need to find a way to marry these two and exist.
That's very right.
Yeah, symbiotically. They support each other, because one without the other is sick in my in my mind.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's the finding the balance, is it? It's bringing together the, I guess it is sort of bringing together the two dualities, the two worlds, the day and the night, you know, and bringing them together. And it's interesting, Gaika, I was actually just reading Jung's Red Book. There's a passage in about needing these two sort of disparate forces, that they need, like, bringing, there's a need to bring them together. One cannot exist without the other. The need to bring them together, and bringing them together, that is the serpent's path. Like, that's where the serpent is.
Oh, there's that winged serpent. We've circled back to the beginning. I love that. It reminded me that I wanted to say something earlier when we were talking about, like, Chthonic Sun. And this is like, what did I learn during Venus and Leo when it comes to self-worth? I remember one day sitting at the altar with my spirits, and I'm like having my Venus in retrograde Kazemi moment. And I'm like, where is the worth predicated? And I'm like, it cannot be predicated on anything that I identify as. That identity is constantly changing. So I can't ever predicate worth on, I'm a badass witch, I'm in grad school, you know, whatever. I've got the most badass friends in the world. All those things might be true, but that's not where the fountain of my self-love can come from. So I started to ask myself, what does solve at coagula mean? You know, and it's this like solve, the lovers, to break everything down and say, none of these binaries are true, and we don't fucking understand anything, and you're not who you think you are, and I'm not who I think I am, and what do we do? What do we do? Why does Crowley call the Temperance card art? Why is the solve card called art? Why is the coagula card art? Because after you've solved, after you've taken the sword of intelligence and you've broken everything down and you say nothing is true, the only thing you can do is create. The only thing left is to dance.
And I love that. That is beautiful. And I feel like, you know, that's like really reflected in the process of the making, right? It's like, what is the process of making art? It's like, it's really, you're going through so many different emotional states, and there is this kind of like, there's this resistance and this sort of overcoming of this resistance. There's always a struggle, right? There's always a struggle inherent in it. Well, that's my experience. And then you overcome the struggle, and then you get to this sort of resolution space. You just come back and you do that over and over again. And so it is like inherent within that. It's the breaking and then the resolution. And I think that exists within the actual experience of the art making.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which all of that is to say that worth should be predicated on your courage to make art.
Yes. Yes. That's true.
Yes.
And how do we actually, and it's also, you know, making art is like, it's, I feel like it's a slow, you know, it's a slow dance, and you don't have a cheer squad behind you doing it, you know. And if you kind of like, and there is the danger of like kind of wanting to be on socials or do, and like have that cheer squad happening. But I think that can be like, that leads to, can lead, I don't know, for me, I'm just talking about my own experiences, can lead to sort of dangerous waters of like wanting or needing that.
Yeah.
And so the idea for me is like, oh, well, how do you kind of keep these sort of these spaces like sort of sacred?
Yeah.
And sort of like doing it for the sake of itself.
Yeah.
You know, like making art for the sake of making art, you know, rather than recognition or, you know,
yeah,
that dopamine hit or,
well, I like that. Because what you're saying is, when I get on social media and I'm posting my art and I'm asking for a cheer squad, you're identifying as an artist. You're saying my self-worth is coming from my identity as an artist. And so you're already pathologizing yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, I do it,
but
I
leave. We all do.
Also, we all need to make a living and exist within the world. But I try to leave, I've got this sort of thing going where, you know, as much as I can, I try to leave gaps, a lot of gaps between like within my process of my work and come to a finish point before I start sharing it with the world. So, and you know, my working now, like, you know, I can spend 3 months on one working that culminates
in, it's so saturnal,
a talisman. Yes.
Yeah.
It's Saturnian.
I love that.
Mm-hmm. We're both Saturnian people.
Only the best for my podcast listeners. Okay, so we're going to move into the last question of the interview. This has been such a good time, but I always like to end the interview on the same question, which is basically an open mic. I'm basically just going to hand it over to you. If there's anything you forgot to tell us, you feel like you'd be remiss if people didn't know, if you want to read a poem or like tell us a story or anything that you want to share. I've had people do literally all of the above for this one, so there's no pressure. It's just whatever you want to share. I've also had people say no thank you, so if you don't want to answer it, you're also allowed to say no thank you.
I have a talk coming up at Astromagia in November. It's running from the 15th to the 17th, and my presentation is entitled Embodied Craft and Living Vessels, The Art of the Talisman. Yeah, and I'm just going to be... I want to talk about, you know, what it means to engage magically, talismanic magic. Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to be looking at sort of what it means to like follow the grimoire practice and also to get off the, you know, the grimoire practice again feels like that well-lit path, and what it means to sort of get off that well-lit path and into the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And what we can find out there.
Ooh, that sounds so exciting. Oh my gosh.
Thank you, Michaela.
You're welcome. People are going to walk away so inspired, I'm sure. There is something to be said about getting that first sign of encouragement to walk off a paved path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'm a Sun Uranus person, so I'm all about it.
Well, then you're the perfect person to teach.
Thank you.
Yay. Okay. Well, I really hope people do that. And then, you have Sun talismans coming out.
I do. Sun and Alpha talismans.
Oh, Alpha as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, at the very least, I will throw in my Instagram stories when you announce those, because
I don't think
I can add them into the episode link, but I'll make sure that people are aware that they are being released when the releases happen.
Well, everything gets released to my subscriber list first.
Oh, so perfect.
I encourage people jumping on, because sometimes things go quickly, depends on the release. And I encourage people to jump on my website, tidesatethes.com, and it's just on the landing page. You can just subscribe there, very easy. And most of the alpha talismans, I think I've spoken for a lot of them. So yeah, I encourage, if you're interested in one of those, jump on there and put your name down. Yeah.
I'll put a link to your website into the episode description as well.
Mm-hmm.
That way people have easy access to all the wonderful and amazing things offered by Jeannie.
Thank you so much, Michaela. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, this was great.
I really loved our chat.
Me too. I hope there's more in the future.
Me too. Would love that.